8:15 having arrived, I'm going to call the Education Finance Committee to order.
We have a bunch of Republican bills we'll vote on right now.
I think we could vote right now. Oh boy, here they start coming in. So we do have a quorum. So before we start, we will Representative Hertaus, would you like to approve the March 19th, 2014 minutes?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we approve the March minutes.
All right. Representative Hertaus moves approval of the March 19th, 2014 minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Those minutes are approved. First bill up is the House File 3171. I'm going to turn over. Oh, here comes Vice Chair Representative Slocum, if you would take over.
He hobbled in on crutches.
Good morning, members.
I know that.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
And if I could, I would like to move at this time House File 3171.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. House File 3171 is the governor's supplemental budget bill, and what this bill entails is a number of technical changes to some of the things that were done last year. And as far as the financial items, it's about $3.5 million for the reduced school lunch program, which actually was already passed out onto the House floor and completed and signed into law, and also about $300,000 for a base adjustment to the Minnesota State Academies. But before I go on, I'm very pleased to carry this bill and want to thank and commend Governor Dayton for his courage and his leadership and vision last year that really allowed us to put forth a bill that will get us and get our kids to the world's best workforce. And without that leadership, I don't think it would have happened. And I think this committee put out an excellent bill. I think the final education bill that was signed into law will really move the state forward. There's a lot of reform in that bill. And what was really important in last year's bill is that it focused on putting dollars into efforts and strategies that had a proven track record of increasing, improving student performance and closing the achievement gap with the all-day, everyday kindergarten, the early learning scholarships, the world's best workforce accountability measures, and then giving teachers and staff and our folks out there working to educate our children the resources to move towards the world's best workforce. So that was all possible with the governor's leadership, Commissioner Casalius's leadership, and the work of this committee and the legislature. So I want to thank Paul for that. So at this point, what I'd like to do is turn this over to either Dr. Melcher or Ms. Cordy, Mr. Cordy, who is here to explain the bill.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity for us to be in front of this committee to talk about the governor's supplemental budget. As Representative Marquardt had stated, for the most part, this bill is a lot of technical changes to some work that was done by this committee and by other committees the waning hours of last session. And of course, when that happens, you know, there's some cleanup that usually needs to happen when you pass a bill of the scale that was passed last session. So Dr. Melcher will go through those. There's also some changes that our Adult Basic Education Division had proposed regarding some of their grant programs, and then of course the school lunch provisions, which Representative Marquardt referred to. So I'm going to throw it over to Dr. Melcher to talk about Article 1 and some of the technical changes that we're referring to.
Madam Chair
and Dr. Melcher,
members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the School Finance Director at the Department of Education. I'm just going to walk through briefly the provisions here in Article 1. Sections 1 and 15 of the bill provide a clarification on the amount of money that school districts set aside for programs at area learning centers, and clarify that current language that specifies that the school districts must set aside at least 90% of their general education revenue mean that they must set aside between 90 and 100% of general education revenue. That is the way the department has interpreted this for a number of years, but there have been some questions about is that only a minimum, and should they be required to set aside more than 100% of revenue? And this would maintain the situation the way that we've interpreted over the years. On page 1, line 27, there's a change from 4.85% of general ed revenue to 4.66%. That's to align with the changes made last year as far as the portion of the basic general education revenue that is attributable to school transportation. On page 2 of the bill, we have changes in the post-secondary enrollment options program that align the calculations to the change in pupil unit weightings from last year. We changed the secondary pupil weight from 1.3 to 1.2. The governor's budget is carrying about a $2.7 million reduction for this item. Without this change, the payments to the colleges would be artificially increased because of the change in the pupil unit weighting. So this aligns it so that there is, in fact, a 1.5% increase to the colleges for PSEO, just like the school district's got a 1.5% increase on the general education formula. Section 3, beginning on page 2, is clarifying that the calculation of general education revenue for charter schools is based on the actual decline in the enrollment in the particular charter school rather than using the state average amount of decline for all school districts in the state, and also clarifies that charter schools do not qualify for location equity revenue. Section 4 of the bill deals with learning year pupil units, and it aligns the calculations for kindergarten to reflect the all-day K provision that was enacted last year, so that you would have to have more than 850 hours of instruction in kindergarten before a school district would qualify for the targeted services additional funding. Section 5 also deals with extended time revenue, and in making the changes last year, the bill inadvertently excluded the formula for 2014. So this is clarifying that for 2014, the formula stays at $4,600 times the old pupil unit calculation, so that we're not inadvertently providing an increase to $5,017 in 2014 when we're still using the old pupil unit weights. Section 6, dealing with equity revenue, is correcting the definition of pupil units. We switched from using resident pupil units to adjusted pupil units last year, and that is to conform to the changes made last year. The same thing on Section 7 and 8. We're eliminating the reference to the obsolete marginal cost pupil unit concept, and instead using adjusted pupil units consistently here. Section 9 deals with transition revenue, which is a hold harmless provision. And on page 7, we are inserting a reference to the Alternative Teacher Compensation, or QCOMP, program. This aligns the calculation to reflect the rollout of QCOMP from the general education program to a separate categorical. So it makes sure that we're including QCOMP in both the old formula calc and the new formula calc, so we have an apples-to-apples comparison for purposes of our transition revenue guarantee. Section 10 is deleting an obsolete reference to fiscal year 2003. Section 11 is correcting the calculation of the referendum aid guarantee to reflect the action in the tax bill last year that added location equity revenue into the mix. So this is saying that the guarantee for referendum aid is based on the sum of the referendum aid and the location equity aid, which replaced part of the referendum aid. Without this change, we'd inadvertently be guaranteeing a district more than what they got in the past. Section 12 on referendum revenue. If you go down to page 10, we're again correcting a pupil unit reference. We changed from using resident marginal cost pupil units to using adjusted pupil units, and there was one cross-reference that didn't get corrected last year dealing with petition referendums. Section 13 is clarifying that when we do the location equity revenue calculations, we are using a stacking approach where the school districts can qualify for both the $300 increase in referendum and the location equity revenue. That is how the department is currently administering that provision in calculating last year's levies. Section 14 on the Safe Schools levy is correcting a pupil unit reference again on the top of page 12, eliminating the reference to marginal cost pupil units. Section 15, dealing with area learning centers, again, is clarifying a cross-reference and, again, clarifying that at least 90% of Gen Ed revenue means between 90 and 100% of Gen Ed revenue. Section 16 is the appropriations section, and that is correcting for forecast changes and for the change in the post-secondary enrollment options correction that I mentioned earlier. Moving into Article 2, the Section 1 is correcting a cross-reference. Section 2, dealing with achievement and integration revenue, is clarifying that the funding under the new formula is the lesser of 100.3% of the district's expenditures or the formula amount. The reason for the 100.3% is that 0.3% is transferred to the department. So basically the district is guaranteed that they'll get the lesser of what the formula says or what their budget is, and then the extra 0.3% goes to the department for some increased accountability for reviewing school district integration budgets. The incentive revenue is another change in the achievement and integration. That's Section 3 in Article 2. And that, again, is clarifying that the funding for incentive revenue is the lesser of the formula amount or the district's approved expenditures for that program. So basically, in order to generate the achievement revenue, you actually have to have a budget and spend the money for that purpose. It's not just an automatic amount that you get. And then moving into Article 3 on special education, the first section is including a cross-reference to the location equity provisions. It clarifies that location equity revenue or the location equity levy is not a subtraction in calculating excess cost aid. The state has always excluded referendum revenue from general ed revenue for purposes of calculating special education aid. Since location equity replaces part of referendum, this also would exclude the location equity to be consistent with past practice. Section 2 are some corrections of the special education formula, but also a change in the governor's recommendations that would allow the Faribault Academies to receive funding for one-on-one certified licensed professionals, as well as one-on-one certified or one-on-one paraprofessionals. So that is a change. There is a small fiscal impact to that. Section 3 also refers to the inclusion of funding for one-on-one licensed certified professionals as well as one-on-one paraprofessionals for the Faribault Academies. Section 4 is a clarification of the special education calculations. It clarifies that we exclude the pupil transportation expenditures from the portion of the formula based on 62% of the expenditures. That gets included later on as a separate calculation on page 20, line 14. You'll see where the other reference to transportation. It avoids us double counting transportation. Section 5 is, again, a correction, a clarification of the formula, which matches the way that this was intended and the way that the department is currently calculating the special education aid. Section 6 is a cross-referencing correction to get the terminology consistent. Section 7 is clarifying the calculation of special education excess cost aid for the current biennium, and also clarifying again that we do not include location equity levies as a subtraction factor in calculating excess cost aid. Again, that's consistent with current practice of not including referendum in the calculation of excess cost aid. Section 8 is again aligning the terminology for the excess cost aid calculations. And Section 9 is simplifying and clarifying the language as it relates to tuition payments for students who are placed out of state, again consistent with current practice. And then Section 2 is aligning the, or is increasing the appropriation for the state academies based on another governor's recommendation to increase their funding by $300,000. And that gets us to Article 4.
Right.
Yes. Madam Chair and members, Article 4 is basically exactly the same as what we saw in the Seltzer bill, which you've already heard. So we can just skip over that. And then
Mr. Haskamp.
And I would ask if it pleases the committee to have Brad Haskamp, who's with our Adult Basic Education Division, to speak to the changes in Article 5 regarding the changes in adult basic ed grants.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Article 5 with, my name is Brad Haskamp with the Minnesota Department of Education, and Section 1 of Article 5 really allows for the maintenance of statewide support services and innovative grants that help local adult basic education consortia, primarily due to federal cuts in funding that we've received over the past couple years due to sequestration and other events. So this first one in Section 1 would increase the per provider cap to from 20% to 40%, and this really allows for continued access of and comprehensive services for these local programs, especially greater Minnesota programs that receive travel scholarships and staff receive special additional funding to attend these events throughout the state. In addition, it allows for these events to happen in various locations instead of just metro locations, especially in areas of professional development, educational technology, and volunteer training. Section 2 raises the total allocation for supplemental services from 2% to 3%. And again, this is due to federal cuts that we've received over the past couple years, totaling more than $1 million. This, again, ensures that local programs get the support that they need, especially in professional development, ESL training, reading training, technology and distance learning training, testing services, and disability services. If we move into Section 3, this is just more of an update to current federal metrics. Currently, or when this funding formula was originally designated for local programs, the federal government census tracked age 20 over without a diploma for by school district, but that metric has since changed, and now it is over 25 no diploma that can be tracked by school district area. So in order for us to keep up with current population metrics, it's important to change that from 20 to 25 so that we can use current data and not be reliant on 1990 census data.
And Madam Chair, Article 6 is simply all the forecast adjustments to reflect the changes in the February forecast, and I believe that completes the bill. We'd be happy to stand for any questions you might have.
Thank you. Are there any questions among the members at this point? Representative Quam?
No, this is anywhere within the bill question.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was curious as to the changes in the nutrition section for school breakfast and kindergarten milk, the decreases or cuts, page 33, lines 24, 26, 31, and 33. I'm trying to understand why there are cuts to school breakfast and kindergarten milk.
Sure.
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, I believe that those are just forecast adjustments to result to reflect updated pupil counts.
Okay.
Mr. Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And also, I'm curious, is it forecast results that also on page 31 cut the aid for children with disabilities, line 29 and 31?
Mr. Forty?
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, yes, I think this is just an update to reflect current enrollment that projected in the February forecast.
Less kids.
Madam Chair, I've noticed that there are also cuts in education excellence for the achievement and integration aid, page 29, a little over $3 million on line 13, just under $6 million on line 15, and then literacy incentive aid on line 23 is a couple million, and line 25 looks to be over $6 million in cuts to the literacy aid.
Representative Quam, I'm going to ask Mr. Strom to answer that.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, the arrangement that the legislature and the executive branch use for forecast adjustments is as follows. The K-12 committee is essentially required to fully fund any formula that's in statute. So we're not allowed to prorate an amount if we think school lunch costs $12 million for the year. That's the amount we have to put in that. And if the count changes, so fewer people use lunch than we expected and there's savings, that's an automatic forecast reduction. So with each of these programs, if there's an increase or a decrease, it's still the same formula that's generating the amount, but the reduction or the increase is due to the working rules, essentially, of whether things are counted in the forecast or not. So all the changes in the back part of the bill here that are forecast adjustments reflect one of three things. They can reflect greater or smaller participation in the program. They can reflect a change in something like the shift, which is affected in some of these appropriations, or they can affect a policy change. But essentially what's happening is we're required to fully fund each program, and if the funding for that program goes up, there's no charge to this committee in terms of its target to fund that, and if it goes down, there's no savings to this committee, but the lower amount of appropriation is put in or the higher amount is put in to better reflect the forecast.
Madam Chair, then we would know, since the forecasts were changed, how many fewer students there are to make up for the tens of millions of dollars in cuts that are present here. I guess I'd like to understand that, because when we look through all the sheets and we look for bills that we can add programs to, et cetera, and we've got numbers for the pupil enrollment, if there's been a shift, it'd be nice to know how many students were delta in this correction, and also what is the total number of dollars that then become available? Because I just in the few that I've looked at, some in transportation too, there are tens of millions of dollars that might be available for other areas, and when we're getting presentation on this technically corrected, it'd be nice to have the bottom line of there were X number fewer students than we had last year calculated, and then that in turn shuffled out to an additional $35.73 million that then is available to the bottom line. I mean, I'd like that information. I think it'd be useful.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, the forecast document actually includes that information in it. So when the Department of Management and Budget puts together the forecast, the Department of Education sends to them a document that shows where these changes are and explains what was the result or what caused those changes. So, for example, if you go to page 13 and look at the general education appropriation, you can see that in fiscal year 14, that's up $800 million. But this committee doesn't have to pay for that under its target. That's mainly a shift change, but there are also some changes in pupil units built into that number as well. But for budgeting purposes, the concept that's important to keep in mind is that this committee's budget target is determined according to base. Our target this year, which is $75 million above base, does not get bigger or smaller if base changes. It floats along with that. So if one of the programs like literacy aid is smaller than the amount of the appropriation, that is not additional money for this committee to spend. This committee's spending target is driven by that base and the delta over the base. So the issue then is, if you want to see the individual components of that, the forecast highlights the major ones that change, and detailed information from the department can show where some of these other changes are coming from. But for example, on school lunch, the issue there was slightly fewer meals were served than we were estimating at the time the bill was assembled last session. So there's a variety of reasons that these can change. The literacy aid, for example, had a big drop in it. That was primarily because the new test was harder than the old test, and the formula was not corrected last year. But the formula is what drives the appropriation, and the idea with the adjustments is to hit the actual appropriation that the formulas are at 100% funding for the formula.
One last thing. What page does it, Madam Chair? What page does it show us the number of fewer students there are?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, that's in the forecast document, and we'll get a copy of that document for you, and that will specify in each year how many more or fewer students the department is estimating than before.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Dr. Melcher on page 18, where you were noting the addition on line 26. Of one-to-one licensed certified professional for the academies. Does that account for the $300,000 increase then? The fact that we're adding 68% of the salary of one-to-one licensed and certified professionals at page 18, line 26.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, no.
Dr. Melcher?
There is a... The $300,000 is for an increase in the base appropriation for the state academies, essentially that their funding has not kept pace with the increases in the general education formula. So the $300,000 is for basically a general operating increase for the academies. The other money that relates to the for the one-on-one professionals, that will show up in the state special education aid budget, because what that's doing is saying that they can get funding for a percentage of those salaries. So you'll see that in the special education aid budget.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is directed towards Mr. Strom. On page 35, line 12, concerning early childhood family education aid, I notice... And I would like you to just clarify for me, please. I noticed the 2014 appropriation includes additional monies for the 2013 year. The 2015 appropriation includes more for this year. And there are some numbers there. And without the spreadsheet, could you just kind of clarify that for me in terms of what's going on there and with regard to how much is being spent currently or had been spent last year in 2013? Are we making significant increases in this area, or is it just these more, what appears to be more modest increases?
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Hertas, these are appropriations numbers, and for many of these numbers, the shift is going to be the biggest change that's in them, the going from paying 86.4% or some amount smaller than that to 90% is what's causing these numbers to jump around. Ms. Johnson tracks programs on an aid entitlement basis. And so if you'd like, we'd be happy to put a worksheet together for you that shows the aid entitlements for these, and then you can see sort of the real effect of program growth or change. For ECFE, essentially the formula's been flat for the last several years. The participation level, it's based on the count of 0 to 4-year-olds. That count hasn't changed very much. And so really the overall aid entitlement for that program has been very flat, but we can show you that separately, and we'd be happy to put together a document for you that shows aid entitlements for these. But the appropriations in the abstract aren't very helpful for you because they're correcting for shift and that kind of thing as well.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Strom, what I'm hearing then is that the aid shift is going up in percentage from 86.5% to 90%. And I received last night from a school superintendent a rather long letter about early childhood family education. So I guess it caught my attention and why I was looking what we were doing.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, Representative Hertaus, and for an individual program provider, there's no change at all in funding. Their pupil count probably hasn't changed. Their entitlement for that year hasn't changed. So there's nothing in this forecast adjustment that shows them any benefit or not. It's just our way of doing our accounting and adjusting the amounts actually appropriated to match the shift levels.
Okay, so I should send him no help.
Madam Chair, Representative Hertaus, do not take credit for an increase that's no change in revenue. Yes.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions from members? Then it's time for public testimony. Is there anyone in the public that wishes to testify for or against? Thank you. Representative Markwart, would you like to renew your motion, and I believe House File 3171 will be laid over. Am I correct?
That's correct. I'd just like to thank the members and thank staff here from MDE for describing the bill and so forth, and we'll be working with this as we move forward with our on this bill. So thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Moran with House File 2275.
Representative Moran, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2275.
Very good. Is there any amendments to this bill? All right. Please proceed.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members, and just like to thank you for giving me this opportunity to bring this bill to the committee. So I just want to start off by saying that in 2013, we made a huge investment, I would say an historical investment, in education from pre-K to post-secondary. And I can say that we can be really proud of the investment that we made based on evidence-based and research-based legislation. Really, really excited about that. And so before you is a bill that's asking you to appropriate money to the St. Paul Promise neighborhood so that local community members in partnership with schools can continue the great work of improving outcomes for children. But what we do know that in order to do that in high needs areas, some will call those areas low income, some will call them under-resourced areas, that more is needed to achieve those gaps and improve their achievement gap, which some would say will also be an opportunity gap. And so before you today is a proposal to work towards partnering with schools and the state to create better outcomes for all kids in the state of Minnesota, and to do that in a way that is holistic, that wraps around services, not just for that child, but for the family, so that we can begin to create communities where all children thrive. And so I would stop there and would like to invite my first testifier to present.
Very good. If you'd please. There you go. Thank you. Please state your name for the committee and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Munir Karcharamos. I'm the director of the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, and I'm here representing my staff and the 1,500 scholars who are enrolled, as well as their families, in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. The St. Paul Promise neighborhood is a cross-sector collaborative organization engaging parents to reduce multi-generational poverty and the achievement gap. Our focus is on three elementary schools and a network of early learning providers. In the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, we invest in the early years of our children, of our scholars' lives, to influence the trajectory of their academic success. We know that upstream solutions are both preventative and deliver greater return on investment. We know that investing early is happening at a time when our babies' brains are being built, literacy skills are being developed, and their academic trajectory is being set. In the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, we are aligning with existing early learning opportunities that work, as well as developing new ones. In total, our families are participating in a range of 8 different early learning programs and opportunities through prenatal through K entry and then up through third grade into elementary school. Some of these programs include the Child Parent Center model at 2 of our sites. This is a successful model coming out of Chicago with a lot of evidence backing it, trying to build out from the early years into K and then into elementary school. We have our own baby college, which is modeled after the successful evidence-based practice for African American and Hmong families called Incredible Years. We're working with a network of 15 early learning centers and providers who are serving over 240 of our youngest learners who are receiving St. Paul Promise Neighborhood Early Learning Scholarships through the Federal Race to the Top. All of these programs are going through rigorous evaluation that are producing important local data so that we can understand what works here and can be replicated elsewhere in the state. With all that said is that many of our family scholars and programs who are in this early learning world, we're seeing an increased demand to coordinate and align the partnerships to maximize our impact across these programs, even though we know that they have tremendous results. So this is why we're looking for half of our appropriation in this bill to be used to hire an early learning navigation team. That navigation team includes a partnership coordinator, a navigator coordinator, a program assistant, and 7 navigators. So this is the team that leads on the ground efforts to ensure that our scholars are meeting 2 of our goal areas. Children are ready for kindergarten, and children are reading at proficiency by the end of third grade, which are both strong predictors of high school graduation. Currently, 1 in 3 of our scholars are participating in early learning programs in the neighborhood. 18% of the scholars at our 3 elementary schools are reading at proficiency by the end of third grade. So those numbers there are even lower than what our graduation rates are right now, which is 49%. So the trajectory with those strong predictors of kindergarten readiness and reading proficiency by third grade, our trajectories are actually lower than what our graduation rate is now. So we're really looking to get that investment to help align our work, because we know that the achievement gap is real now, and in the future, if we don't have that coordinated support and the boots on the ground with our navigators to maximize the investments that are already being made. The other half of our investment, or just under half of the investment, would be to expand our academic as well as family and community wraparound supports with existing neighborhood programs and services that have proven to be effective. We're looking to build out our highly effective summer reading loss prevention program, Freedom School, but we want to tailor that within the Southeast Asian community, but the Hmong community particularly, which makes up about a third of all of our scholars. We plan to work with existing partners to build up programs that address the barriers in the educational process around housing education and employment education. So we may ask ourselves is what do these wraparound supports have to do with the achievement gap? So with half of our families working, earn less than $18,000 a year. We have families who are renters. We have families who are either homeless or highly mobile, and this translates into about 1 in 5 of our scholars who are actually turning out of our schools. So these wraparound supports help stabilize our families and look at really the comprehensive approach that's needed to attend to the academic achievement gap. If Pam James was here, who is one of our navigators, she would tell you that our wraparound supports aren't employment first or employment or housing first type of programs. They're actually education programs where we're helping our families understand what does it look like, what is the connection between your home life and school, what is that educational process, and why does family stability matter. So we're really looking at backing that up and being able to build that out. So with the support from the state of Minnesota, expansion of the navigation system and our wraparound supports, it would not only increase the capacity to serve those who were already serving, but would also allow us to enroll about 750 additional scholars, bringing us to a total of 2,250 scholars, which is well on our way to achieving our tipping point within our St. Paul Promise neighborhood, which is about half of the scholars in the neighborhood. So we would want to see all of our kids have access to great early learning programs, schools, strong systems of support, and we're hoping that the investment can start here with the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Representative Moran, do you have other testifiers?
Yes, I do. We have
And are these testifiers going to testify to the financial aspects or to the program generally?
More of the program.
Okay, because I know this was heard in policy also, so please proceed. Yeah, and just kind of just to a minute or two if you can, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kizzy Downey, and I'm here today as the Director of Community Services with Model Cities of St. Paul. Model Cities is a private nonprofit organization created in 1967 with a mission to deliver services that promote the physical, mental, spiritual, social, and economic well-being of families, individuals, and communities. I'm also here today representing 72 partner organizations of the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. Disparities in our neighborhood are disheartening, with the achievement gap being most notable. Each and every partner in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood believes that these disparities are unacceptable. We're working hard to improve the conditions of children and families that we're serving, and we're hoping that we can get your support in helping us to do that. Like in many urban communities, there are many agencies in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood working to improve the conditions of families. Because the need is so great, it is vital that community-based agencies strategically align their efforts in order to produce greater impacts. In the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, we have shifted our focus from making isolated impact as individual agencies to doing collective impact as a network of agencies. This means that we have a common goal and a common agenda, and we understand our respective roles in reducing the achievement gap and other disparities affecting our community. Now we're taking a comprehensive approach so that we know that the right family is in the right place at the right time. We are seeing how family and community supports make a difference in the life of a family and in addressing the achievement gap. These changes are largely because of the existing roles of the partnership coordinator and the navigation system. We know this arrangement works, and we know that it being expanded will allow the St. Paul Promise neighborhood partners to serve more families. It is the connective tissue that ensures our agencies are aligned and investments go further. The achievement gap is an adaptive challenge. There is no simple solution. We're trying new things, and we're on the right path in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. We ask for your support and investment in our data-driven, comprehensive, community-based approach to closing the achievement gap once and for all. Thank you.
Ms. Downey, thank you so much, and I appreciated the testifier's focus on closing the achievement gap. Thank you. Representative Moran, one more testifier.
We have a parent here, too, who would like to testify.
You bet. And welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Letitia Carter, and I am new to the district, and I have two children at Maxfield School, which is in the Promise neighborhood. And since coming to Maxfield, getting involved with the navigators in the Promise neighborhood, I have become more concerned, more conscious about what I do and say in my household. Before coming to this school, my child was held back, and he is now in the third grade and in a gifted and talented program. And this is very important and critical in his life right now, because now is the time that society decides whether they're building presence or opening college doors for him. I am more engaged in my community than I have ever been. due to my awakening from the Navigators. I am a member of PASAP, FRAN, and the Cultural Wellness Center, and because of the Navigator system, I am more aware of the things that I do, and as a self-study of myself, I have come up with a new saying: identify, recognize, and rectify. I am now employed in the St. Paul Public School System as a coordinator. This was all due to my involvement with the Navigators. And in conclusion, your investment in the Navigator system is an investment in parents like me and our children and their future. Thank you.
Ms. Carter, thank you. Members, any questions for the testifiers? Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, I guess it's not for the testifiers. It's for Representative Moran. Representative Moran, would you please just elaborate on the history of the funding for the program, how long it's been in existence, where the money has come from in the past?
Yep. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I'm going to defer that to the testifier.
Mr. Karcher-Ramos.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the history of the St. Paul Promise neighborhood is we began with a planning grant, federal grant, in 2010. And since then, we have been working with primarily local funding. So it came from a variety of sources, so local philanthropy, so the different foundations, as well as aligned resources from our public systems, our local public systems, the school, the school system, the city, and the county, as well as we have other project-based federal grants that we're looking at and or that we're
Representative Myra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moran, I'm looking at lines 1.16 through 1.18, and it talks about this report must be submitted within 3 months of the close of each legislative biennium. The initial initiative receives funding. I wonder if it wouldn't be helpful to clarify that it is state funding, because obviously you have been receiving funding since 2010. Also, what do you mean by report here? What would be reported?
Okay. Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair and Representative, one of the things that I am really excited about bringing this bill forth is that it is really a collaboration that comes from the community, from local folks who are invested in creating better outcomes for our kids and closing the achievement gap. And so this is also their bill that they brought to me and wanted to be held accountable to creating and being able to report back the outcomes of the partnership that's been created here. And so I'm going to pass that on to Munir and allow him to respond to the reporting piece of it.
Mr. Karcher-Ramos.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the reporting aspect of this very much aligns with understanding the federal, so in line 113 and 114, it's a federal Promise Neighborhood Program agreements and requirements. So with that, there's a number of indicators related to academic achievement that need to be reported on, as well as anything else that's done with that investment. So it's digging deeper in there and really focused on results-based accountability to make sure that this is continued to be a good investment for the state. At the federal level, we also use results-based accountability to ensure that our funding, if you receive that federal funding, that it continues. So the report is digging deeper into the different indicators for us. It'll be, children ready for kindergarten, children reading at proficiency by third grade, looking at the different programs that are contributing to that, understanding practices that work, and learnings based on the innovation that's done within the
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, I think it would just be helpful if there was some clarification in those lines. One is that it is state funding that you're talking about. Otherwise, the report would already be due, right? Then also clarify what you're going to be reporting to the legislature. Thank you.
I think those suggestions are good.
Yeah.
Is there anyone in the audience who would care to speak? Oh, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Archer Ramos. Your mission statement, although there's no particular title on here for your mission statement, but it does communicate to me a very important mission statement of ensuring that every student succeeds, because that's important in every neighborhood in Minnesota for every child. And I'm just curious on your funding. I see on the back of your brochure it has all the list of people that invest in your St. Paul neighborhood, the Promise neighborhood. And you got a lot of great organizations and a lot of people that are invested in it. So I'm just curious on two questions are your budget. What is the kind of your budget that you set for the year? What percentage is for admin? And as far as reporting, I would surmise that some of the organizations that invest kind of want to see a progress report of their investment and how they're making this neighborhood much better.
Yeah, Mr. Archer-Romas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for this appropriation, we'll be using the funding for filling out that navigation system and the wraparound support. So that funding would go directly to funding those positions as well as that program. Currently, our budget, we're operating on about a $1.1 million budget that goes through us, and then aligned funding is about another $2 million. It doesn't go through us, but that is aligned and coordinated and directed by the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. In terms of reporting, we're really moving. We have some results that we've already delivered with our Freedom School program with 91% not experienced some of the learning loss. We have other federal grants that have reporting that come with it, as well as so our Race to the Top scholarships. We have our year one report on that that's been returned. So we're packaging all that up right now to create our annual reporting for from last year. So we can report back.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So your budget, annual budget at this point, or your funding is, what, around $3 million? Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. And what, you didn't mention your administration, kind of what percentage goes to administering the programs that you have, that you've listed in your program administration statement?
Carter Ramos.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the percentage that goes to administrative is approximately 8%. Goes into administration, and then the rest of it goes into program directly, so that could go into staff.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So question for Representative Moran, and perhaps Mr. Strom, but he's out of the room, but maybe the chair can help on this. Now our goal is to, you said, Mr. Chairman, at the beginning of the year, to close the achievement gap for everyone in Minnesota, St. Paul neighborhood included, Minneapolis, Delano, all of our districts. And we appropriated a lot of money, millions and millions of dollars, to close that up, close the achievement gap. And I looked into the funding, the formula, the mechanism for school financing for St. Paul and Minneapolis and areas to close the achievement gap. Are we not being successful? Representative Moran, that you have to bring a bill forward that you are excited about, and I can see you're excited, and I don't blame you, I would be too. It's a lot of money to the budget, to their budget, to help close the achievement gap. But what are we not doing correct that you need even more money from the state when our goal from the get-go was to close the achievement gap from the beginning? Yeah. And yet that doesn't seem to be enough. We need even more money to close that achievement gap. Yeah. Where are we going wrong? Is this money even needed? Our budget isn't even finished yet. Maybe we should allow this money percolate into the school districts to see if we are achieving closing that achievement gap before even asking for more money into it. Yeah. You know, I just have a concern that the more money we throw into problems without even stepping back and analyzing the data, because Mr. Strom, what amount did we allocate for the education budget last year?
Mr. Strom, I think our target at the end was $485 million, not including kind of some of the levy aid part that was included in the tax bill, which probably brought it up to about $525 million, maybe roughly. But Mr. Strom probably could give you, but roughly in that part.
Okay, roughly. Yeah. So are we jumping the gun, Representative Moran? Are we not allowing that money to take root and work in the school systems to close the achievement gap, to work like the fields? You plant the seeds and you let it grow and harvest it at the end of the fall. I don't think we're having an opportunity to even see the results from spending the taxpayers' dollars in neighborhoods. Now, coming back asking for more money. So perhaps we should pause, let the money that we voted on and the governor passed take root and grow before even asking them to throw in more money on it.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McDonald. Great statement. And, you know, what I would say is that we are still working towards closing the achievement gap. And the investment that we made in education was a huge investment and a much needed investment. And when we look at closing the achievement gap, there are many partners and many avenues that we need to go to have a complete package and ensure that all kids are being successful in school and in life. I don't shy away from saying that I am really proud that we have a majority that saw the need to invest in education, because we all know that investment in education just is a way out of so many people to have a way out of poverty, to be self-sustained, to have an accountability to themselves, to their families, to a community, and to our state. So it's a huge investment. But we also know that kids who come from high-need community, when there are many factors that are impacting their lives, like poverty, like lack of jobs, lack of resources, they're highly mobile, that mental illness is a part of that, loss of hope, impacts outcomes. So to have a community, local communities and families working in partnership with the schools. And in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, there are three focused schools where 80% of the population are communities of color. And there's challenges that comes with that. And we're saying that we want to be a part. We are saying that we want to be a part of that partnership to create those better outcomes for our kids, to work towards closing that gap, and to do it in an intentional, collaborative manner that is holistic, that provides families and children with the wraparound services that they need to thrive. Are we on that path to closing the achievement gap? I hope, but this is some legislation we moved in 2013, and we know that we all play a part in creating those outcomes. It's not just the barrier of the schools. It is a community. It's parents. It is local organizations that create change, that create better outcomes, that work towards closing the achievement gap, and it takes resources to do that. And so our hope is that the state can invest in communities, partners, working towards closing the achievement gap, because the effort and the need is huge.
One final.
Lastly, right,
Representative McDonald.
To the testament of the parent, I'm thrilled and excited to hear of your success. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Now, back in the day, we used to have our faith-based church groups, and Mr. Archimeros, I hope maybe you'll respond to this. Churches and the civic groups help people in need. And I think if we neglect them or don't include them into helping people that need help, you said you needed help and you got help, you got a job and your kids and you're a better parent, you're a better citizen, you're better actively engaged in the community, that's what we want. But government isn't always the answer. We can be an obstacle sometimes, not all the time, but are you reaching out as the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, are you reaching out to the faith-based organizations, your churches and groups that at one point helped all in need, not always just the government?
We've got four on the list here, and I'd like to know if any of the members have a specific question on the finance right now or further debate on this, which is good, but we have Representative Mallory's bill, which really kind of covers the same thing. And if we could bring that forward, or does someone have a specific question on the finances? Otherwise, we can come back to kind of the programs, because the next bill is very identical. So, members, is that all right, or is there someone that has a specific question too? because otherwise we can still have the general debate, but let's come back. So I'm going to go to House. Is there anyone who has in the audience that would like to testify for or against 2275? If not, Representative Moran, any last comments?
So, again, just thank you so much for the opportunity to bring this bill before the committee. And I think your priorities is our priorities, and that priority is working towards closing the achievement gap, and I think this would be definitely on point to working towards that ends and creating the world's best workforce.
Thank you very much. Chair will lay over House File 2275 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Representative Mowry. Who would like to move 2273? Anyone? Representative Radenovich moves House File 2273. Representative Mowry, you can present your bill. You heard some of the discussion. We might continue some of that further discussion. Would you present your bill and introduce your
testifier? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yes, this is somewhat, it's in scope. It's like the St. Paul Promise neighborhoods. It's like Jeffrey Canada's in Harlem. There's various ones across the country. Each one takes a little different form as they fit what's best for the neighborhood that they're working on and the population of that neighborhood. And so the Northside Achievement Zone is one in North Minneapolis. It's as... And here with me is Sandra Samuels, the director, and David Devine, the senior director of finance. With regard to some of the discussion that just occurred, this is enveloping basically everything in the life of the children, the parents, the peers, everything in that area to try and help succeed and create very successful people in life. And in the long run, you've seen the numbers from research that it's anywhere from 10 to 20 times you get back at least on the amount you put in, because the people, instead of many people, Representative McDonald, you should follow and see the money that we put into the 411s in the and 412s in the prison system, for instance. And by the way, after listening to you, when your aunts come over, we're going to have to again pray for you to get on board. Ms. Samuels will go through the specifics, but with regard to the question, all of those are, for instance, in... I believe Andre Dukes is a minister at one of the largest churches on the north side, and he was he's one of the directors. He testified on in our committee just a couple nights ago as far as the we're trying to set up a similar program to up to 8 around the state, not just 2. And also, I believe, isn't Fred still on your chair of the board? Or something?
No.
Oh, isn't he? But he was from United Way.
Oh, yeah, so Frank.
I'm sorry,
Frank.
Yeah, Frank. Not Fred. So everything is involved with this, and you have to have that to succeed. Just, you can't continue trying to solve problems by a silo here and a silo here. That's one of the things why our committee was created, the one that I chair, was to break down all the silos on this and force people to work together. And this is an excellent example of what's happening on trying to get rid of all of these throwing money in little pockets and not coordinating everything. And so Ms. Samuels will explain it, and it's received national attention. She'll go into that.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Mowry. And this bill was heard in, Chair Mowry, your committee and also in policy committee. So the policy has been talked a lot about. But Ms. Samuels, if you could really talk to the you know, where is this $1.1 million that's being requested here? How is that going to be spent?
Okay. So Thank you don't want to hear about how we're the program overall?
Well, first? Just that's fine, but I'm very interested in really that's this committee is where are those dollars going and how will that close the achievement gap? So thank you, Ms. Samuels.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Sandra Samuels. I'm president and CEO of the Northside Achievement Zone. And I will be quick in terms of just telling you about our model and then get right into what the finance is. And then if you have any direct questions, our director of finance is here to answer those as well. But about 5 years ago, 50 Northside leaders came together. We heard about the Northside Achievement Zone. We were from the health community, the faith community, education, violence prevention, housing. And the question got called, could we do Harlem Children's Zone in North Minneapolis, a place that cost the state significant money, and that is very distressed, still and has been for a long time. And I've been living there about 18 years now. And anyway, so we all said, well, let's look at our outcomes. We only have 9% of our children ready for kindergarten. Only 27% are reading at a third grade level by third grade. Only 24% are at an eighth grade, doing math at an eighth grade level. And at that time, we only had a 36% high school graduation rate for African-American children, which we call scholars, because underneath the achievement gap, we believe is the belief gap. So that's something that we address. And so we decided at that time that what was happening could not just be on the shoulders of the schools, that we needed a comprehensive approach so that we weren't just helping a few children or a couple hundred children who were in a high-performing school, which we don't have a lot of, but that we needed to do something different. And so we started organizing at that point, and we said, okay, ending multi-generational poverty is our goal. We want to address those issues of juvenile adjudication, high mobility, single-parent households, disparate violence. By the way, I just had two murders on my block in North Minneapolis in the last 2 weeks. So it continues unabated. And so we said, we're going to do this. So it's multi-sector, cross-agency. And we are aligning, just like St. Paul, we are aligning our resources, our strategies, our outcomes, the way we measure our performance, so that we can actually reach scope and scale. And we can help more families and more scholars in the zone. But the only way we can do it is do it together. And so in the handout, really quick, what you see, and this is, and I'm going to get right to what we actually, I'm asking you to fund, is our ecosystem is made up of about 27 anchor partners and 9 anchor schools. Those schools are public district, public charter, parochial, and contract alternative. And we have created basically a net for families that has no gaps, where we are partnering with them from the very onset in their own success. Every family gets a NAS connector. That's part of what we're asking you to fund. A NAS connector is from the community. We have 20 right now. We want to expand that because each connector works with about close to 40 families. We want to be able to do more, to reach more. And those connectors are largely African American, Hmong, and Latino. We want to represent the demographics of the community. We hire the attitude, teach, skill. And we've been finding that this has been, in terms of follow-through, families showing up at school, showing up for jobs, for housing. They're doing it because they have a partner, not a savior. They don't need a savior. Well, some would argue. But they need a partner. And that's what we've been offering them as a community. So this is the ecosystem made up of early childhood providers, many who are in this room. We are still benefiting from Race to the Top, and we very much support Many Minds. I want to share some of our outcomes that we've gotten to date. I mean, this is like turning the curve for our families in North Minneapolis. So we have early childhood providers who make up an action team, our academic, the 9 schools, plus colleges are coming together and prioritizing the same families and same scholars. Then our out-of-school time is also part of our K-12. We're spending a lot of money in expanded learning so that we can extend the time that they get on academics. And then the whole family support. This is where stabilizing families. You know, our housing team. If you can I gave you another sheet called 2013 Early Proof Points. And on the back, it talks about the fact that through NAS, 32% of our families who faced homelessness or high mobility during 2013 were stably housed. We have a 25% high mobility rate in the zone. For us, that's significant. The school district has said statistically that for every time a child moves, they lose about 6 months of learning. And we have children in our zone who are moving 5, 6, 7 times, and so it makes a big difference. Career financial pathways, we're working with our families not just on a job but on a career. And then behavioral mental health, which has become really important in the zone. We actually went from 1 navigator to 2 to really address some of the trauma and the adverse childhood experiences that some of our children experience. At the center of everything is our NAS Connect system. It's a virtual village. We track all of our data. We're working hard with Wilder Research, the University of Minnesota. Everything is about results, results, results. We're not waiting to kindergarten to find out if a scholar is ready for kindergarten. We're doing progress monitoring all along. Again, some of the outcomes here. NAS kids are more ready for kindergarten than students who are not enrolled in NAS. Parents in the zone who are NAS parents are more likely to be involved in parent education. I mean, you can read that, and I could go on. And also at the center, and I'm going to really get to the numbers, which are on the last page.
You know, and I've noticed that here, and I think members could look at that. So
yes,
I think
good.
You could.
I'm going to jump right there. And the only last thing, and then all of the numbers will make sense, is at the heart of all of this wraparound support and partnership, we have action area navigators, and they're experts. Because we don't want our connectors to be experts. We want them to be partners. They do home visits. Families come to us. Our connectors are co-located in the schools and other sites. Our navigators are also. So we have academic navigators, whereas the families all get a family coach, which is a NAS connector. The scholars all get a scholar coach, and those are the academic navigators. They're located in our schools.
Samuels, I think I'm going to have to just
okay,
cut
great.
You short.
So here are the numbers.
And I think we've got a lot of this here. It looks
right.
like you're going
right.
to try to double the number of families
exactly.
from 600 to 1,200 to 3,000 scholars. And members, I think it's listed right here how they're going to spend that. So thank you.
Exactly.
I think that's a good background, and I think members can take
good,
a look at
good.
That.
So. I got you. Brevity
thank
is
you.
A leadership skill. I get that.
thank you.
So here it is. But I was really just trying to flesh out the picture of what we were asking for, why it's so important. So so as you can see on the last page and the breakout.
No, Ms. Samuels, I think
oh,
we're,
we don't need to?
I don't think we have to go over that.
Right.
I think the members have can look at that. And I,
okay.
You know, I think your description here was very good, and the
okay.
goals here
good.
And the results, I think, were covered. Any last? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got a number of questions. I'm going to go back to my original list now. So some may not refer to this bill, but that's fine. And Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is partially in response to Representative McDonald. But a few years ago, as you may know, I worked on integration revenue. And I worked with Professor Myron Orfield from the University of Minnesota, who's highly respected and he's an expert in this field. And one of the conclusions we came to is you cannot just throw integration revenue at schools and expect that you're going to close the achievement gap or that you're going to raise the graduation levels. The only thing that really effectively works is this wraparound concept. And I think this is somewhat the concept that Jeffrey Canada had, who was highly successful in New York City. That's what we have to do, and I think that's what Representative Moran and my good friend from Minneapolis, who didn't bring candy, by the way, that they're attempting to accomplish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anzelt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frankly, listening to both authors and...
Anzelt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frankly, listening to both authors and... wonderful testimony from the witnesses, you should feel much more comfortable, Representative McDonald, that the challenges related to closing the achievement gap in the metropolitan area, in the urban core, are incredibly different than those challenges associated with closing the achievement gap in greater rural Minnesota. And frankly, the federal government helped to give birth to both of these programs.
Right.
And
I know it's uncomfortable for some of you, but due to the gridlock in the United States Congress and inability to stay on course and focus on programs of merit, we're being asked to supplant and supplement some federal funding here. And these are programs that are community-based, and they work. And I just think the authors and the testifiers should be commended for making a great case for doing this, and you should feel much more comfortable about this. And lastly, you know, the faith-based community is a partner in both of these efforts. They are partners. But the last time I checked, churches don't have the power to levy or raise real money. But they are partners with all of the other community activists involved in these programs, and I think there's a lot of merit here.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the testimony, and I'm sorry I missed your name.
Sandra Samuels.
Sandra. thank you for your testimony, and just appreciate your passion on this issue, and God bless in your efforts to make things better for the children in our inner cities and state. And I share a similar concern. But just a quick comment and input. I got about 16 comments, but I've narrowed them to one, Representative Marker.
Thank you.
when you look at government programs, try to identify areas where the government programs actually are contributing to the breakdown of the family, okay? And I want to give you an example just from my community. I own an insurance agency, sold health insurance for 30-some years, and I had a young lady, Caucasian, come into my office about 2 years ago. She was about 27, 28 years old. She needed health insurance. And she had graduated from college, and she wasn't earning a lot of income at this time. And so, in quoting her premiums, I finally said, well, maybe you should check with the county, and they might have something for you. And her response to me was, I've already done that. And I said, so you don't qualify for anything? She said, no. But she said, the social worker told me that if I'd have a child out of wedlock, I could sign up for all types of benefits, okay? I said, do you want to do that? She said, no, I don't want to do that, okay? I consider that a travesty in our current welfare system, all right? And the point is that if she would have said to me, well, the social worker told me that if I was married and I had a child, we could sign up for benefits, that would have been consoling to me. But what we've got, you know, the out-of-wedlock birth rate.
Representative Grunhagen, how does this relate to House File 2273?
When I look at the NAS early proof points, I don't see any points in there that would address that type of problem. So I want to simply pass on the information. Look at these programs that are undermining the family. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that Ms. Samuels already knows that I think this Northside Achievement Zone is fantastic work. My question to you will follow up on Representative McDonald. What is your budget, and what do you spend on administration?
Ms. Samuels? Or
I'm going to let our
Mr. Devine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is David Devine. I'm the Senior Director of Finance with Northside Achievement Zone. Our budget for 2014 is $8.9 million, and 20% of that goes towards administration and development costs.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair, Erickson?
Mr. Chair, to you, I noticed that both of these programs are listed already under self-sufficiency and lifelong learning in our printout. I'm just wondering what that's about. They're listed under on lines 145 and 146 of our printout. Both are listed.
Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Representative Erickson, this is preliminary numbers, and I had thought that perhaps the governor's,
Oh.
It's just Okay, sorry. Those pieces were in the wrong place within the bill. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson. Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Matt, did you feel the energy and the excitement in the these testifiers for these two bills? I mean, I'm excited because, frankly, this is touching kids now. It's making a difference in people's lives now. And, you know, we've had the debates before, and, you know, 525 or whatever million, you know, we're putting into this same old, or a little twist on the same old approach. Frankly, these approaches are working, and they're working now. And I'd rather put money into these because, frankly, you could do 150, 200 of these programs. You could affect hundreds and hundreds of schools and thousands or tens of thousands of students. And I think we really have to look at what works and fund it. I mean, it is so rewarding to see people that have invested their lives and go out and make a difference in the community. They're involved. The neighborhoods, everybody is coming together because it was referenced by a previous member who said supplant and supplement. Now, that sounds like the legacy verbiage, but true legacy is what we do provide and give to our children. And it moves on generation to generation. And I say that these programs are truly legacy programs, and they matter, and they make a difference. And when we go through the dollars and cents, because we never have enough to fill everything, I think we really should look at funding what actually works and makes a difference. So I feel the energy, and I feel this excitement, and I say amen to these.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Just quickly, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your testimony, and it is very exciting, and your passion is infectious. And I can see the results of the data that you gave me, and excited to support Representative Mullery's bill, although it'll go to big omnibus bill, I'm sure. But to a point that Representative Van Zels, you too shared a passion, but please don't presume that just because I asked some questions that I'm not in favor of the projects and the mission of the people and the authors. You said, and I'm paraphrasing, that it gives us consternation. We're not happy with it. But that is our job, to ask the questions, to look into the data. If we just sat here like a bunch of zombies as a minority and kept our mouth shut, I wouldn't be doing my service as an elected official. I might as well stay back in Delano and make a living and provide for my family. So please don't presume or even say that we don't care, we're not engaged in great things just because we ask the questions. And I certainly recognize I'm not a fool, even though I'm not a fool. I know that in the inner city, there's a lot more challenges than rural America. And sometimes it costs more money to educate because of many challenges. But I really, and I know you're a good man, and I'm certainly didn't mean it, but we care. Just because we're asking the questions doesn't mean we're not in favor of things. Representative Mullery, thank you for bringing this forward. And Representative Moran, I just, you can see the enthusiasm. They really had their numbers pegged. And Mr. Archomeros, who's in the room, I'm sure they'll work together. I hope that they'll seek each other out because you can share your resources and for the greater good of our children. But we do care. And that's why we ask the questions.
Representative McDonald, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Representative Radenovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comment's brief. This is the second committee that I've seen these two bills in, and I'm heartily encouraged by the sort of change in the tone of the debate, I think. It's glad to see that there seems to be bipartisan support for these programs. I just want to commend both the author and the members of the Northside Achievement Zone, as well as the Promised Neighborhoods, for bringing forward these programs. I think that it's incumbent upon us, especially those of us who don't live in neighborhoods that deal with the type of issues that we see before us today, to understand that a 36% graduation rate is not just a problem in North Minneapolis, that's a problem for all Minnesota. And, you know, when there are two murders on one block in a matter of a week, that's not just a problem for those of us in the north side, but for all Minnesotans. And so I just want to quickly kind of address two of the things that came up. And I think that we should all be heartened by the work that we did in the education bill last year. And I think that one of the great, you know, achievements for us in rural Minnesota was to see all that money that helped address, I think, some very real problems out there where 37 districts didn't have a levy and some districts had gone to four-day school weeks. But it should not be a question of can we do this or can we do that. I think that a good approach probably requires some discipline and some ability to sort of walk and chew gum at the same time. I think it would be hard to take a program like this and put it in every neighborhood because the nature of it is that it's more resource intensive, and that's why it's successful as well. And so a surgical approach where we can address the issues in some neighborhoods across Minnesota, and whether those are in Minneapolis or St. Paul or if they're present in other neighborhoods across Minnesota as well, we shouldn't have a one or the other approach. I think we can do both if we're sensible and if we recognize the success of already existing programs. And just, you know, one comment, because this comes up over and over again, the issue of the faith community and their role in services for Minnesotans, and I've been heartened by the members of the faith community that have come and testified in front of all the committees that I've been in. But I think that one thing to keep in mind is that while they do good work, they all come and ask for state resources. And, you know, whether that's the Catholic Charities and the homeless effort that they've got or the letter that the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church sent to legislators last year asking us to raise revenue fairly on those who can most afford it so that we can provide services for those who most need it. Or if you look at just the lunch bill a few weeks ago where Mazon came in, and you know, their mission is to feed hungry children, and even they recognize that they can't accumulate the resources by themselves to do it. And so they come to the state to be a partner in those efforts, and I think that we should always keep that in mind, that while they're out there on the front lines and leading the way, that oftentimes it's the collective tax dollars of the state of Minnesota that go to aid those programs. So it's not one or the other, it's both.
Thank you. Is there anyone here in the audience that care to testify for or against House File 2273? Mr. Heller? Please state your name.
Yeah, my name is Rick Heller. Unofficially represent the Twice Exceptional Print Disabled. Thank you, Chair and Policy or Education Finance Committee. I come here today to ask one specific question. I've asked it before. Since this is a federal program, targets poverty and achievement gaps. It's about getting more parents engaged. And it's important as they use performance measures and analyze program outcomes. Are these third-party agencies required to follow statutes 6 and E, which has to do with 508, which is about the Rehabilitation Act of Assistive Technology and Web Accessibility 2.0. I think it would be important that as we continue to improve our culture and involvement with the community and we reach out to them, that I would think that since state agencies have to follow this, and I don't know if this is coming out of a state agency, however, they are required to follow that statute. And content accessibility is important for engagement and participation and being challenged, including motivation. I would ask if somebody, perhaps, that sits on this committee could take ownership and ask that question in writing and or orally here at this listening session, because I prefer listening sessions because I can speak orally. That's how I learn. I'd appreciate the time to speak and have this opportunity here again. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you very much. Representative Mulray, any last words on House File 2273?
No, Mr. Chair. It's a great program, and we need to expand it so that we can help this. Actually, it is a huge help for the state in the long run.
Thank you, and thank you to the testifiers. And Chair will lay over House File 2273 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. All right. Thank you. Who would like to move House File 1880? Representative Brainerd moves House File 1880. Representative Winkler also has an A5 amendment. Representative Breinert moves the A5 amendment to get it into the shape the author wants. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment, A5 amendment, is adopted. Representative Winkler, welcome to the committee. And we're a little over time right now. We've got to really quit by 5-2 because there's an education policy bill up that we all need to get to. So thank you. And I know we heard the bill last year and talked about that, and $40 million of new investments were made in the early childhood scholarship. So I know there's some changes. If you want to briefly go to what you're doing here, and then testifiers, and we'll go from there. So thank you, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The bill is quite simple, actually. It increases the amount of funding for early childhood scholarships by $20 million in this budget biennium. It removes the $5,000 statutory cap on scholarship amounts and replaces it with a flexible target for average scholarship amounts to be determined based on individual needs of a child. And it starts in the next biennium and doubles the funding for scholarships until all children who qualify according to the income guidelines are actually able to receive a scholarship. Mr. Chair, with the $40 million that we appropriated last year, we are able to serve about 9% of kids in Minnesota who are at 185% of poverty. With the cap, that means that the children who are most in need, with particularly families who are not eligible for CCAP because of families who are out of work or mental illness or addiction and all kinds of reasons why people are not able to provide access to their children to existing dollar amounts, those are the children who are not eligible for a high-quality early learning experience through a scholarship year-round. And I have a range of testifiers available, Mr. Chair, and I don't think we're going to get to them. Among them are Frank Forsberg from Many Minds and the United Way, Rob Grunwald from the Minneapolis Fed, who has really kind of crunched the numbers on this, Nancy Jost from, I think it's called the Northwest Initiative, to talk about how this has worked in greater Minnesota. Carol Miller is here from Hennepin County. Eric Haugy from AFSCME would testify in support of this bill. There's a whole range of people who can answer any question that you might have, but maybe just give 30 seconds to a minute to Mr. Forsberg.
That sounds good. Mr. Forsberg, thank you, and thanks for the efforts of Many Minds.
Mr. Chair, it's great to be here, and just a couple of brief comments on behalf of the Many Minds Coalition. First, in your materials is a summary of the coalition members, and I just want to remind you that a year ago this coalition didn't exist. We began to create this statewide coalition so we could have a unified voice and a unified presentation to you for a very organized level of support for early childhood education. This coalition continues to grow. It's very diverse, very statewide. It includes business, faith communities, as well as the advocates. What's different today? I think that's an interesting question than a year ago. Today, the infrastructure is now in place due to the efforts of our Department of Education. The first round of scholarships have been put into the hands of parents and children are, in fact, benefiting, and we now have waiting lists. And so the urgency for us is to begin to address those waiting lists with real names of real children. The other thing that's different is we know more about the needs of the children across our state, and that gets us into the issue around the cap and making that more flexible so that children can actually participate in the variety of programs that are available, high-quality programs. So we want to make sure they can enter a Head Start program if that's the best fit for them, and or a full-day child care if that's the best fit for them. We just need more flexibility across the state so that the needs of children are met. And then finally, a very important part of this equation is the quality rating system, parent aware. And as you know, the Race to the Top funds have been driving the expansion of the parent aware quality rating system across the state and across providers. By 2015, just looking ahead, another 40 counties will have come online and will be parent aware eligible, and that's going to also dramatically increase the number of children who are going to have interest in participating in early childhood education. So it's just going to put, you know, more opportunities, more needs out there for us to address. So I'll leave it at that, and we can of course take questions myself or other testifiers.
And I know Ms. Jost is here, and she's probably come from some distance. Would you, West Central Initiative Fund, and so I want to make this worthwhile, so if you just want to quickly address the group here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Nancy Jost. I work for West Central Initiative in Fergus Falls, so I'm sort of representing rural Minnesota today. And I would just like to thank you all for putting $23 million into scholarships last year. And I would just encourage you to add 20 more million because, as Frank said, all of the counties will be eligible for Parent Aware in 2015. And if we don't have any more money, we're still not going to be able to take advantage of it in most of our rural counties. And so I would just encourage you to do that. And the scholarships really are changing children's lives as well as parents' lives. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Very good. Thank you. And I know I have mentioned in here and others that if we, once the achievement gap could be closed, within 15 years, we could potentially improve our gross domestic product from anywhere from 1.8 to 2.8%, which in today's term would be equivalent to five biking stadiums each year. And Mr. Grunwald, who's in the audience, has provided those statistics from the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, so I see you're there. Thank you for being here. I've used those numbers quite often.
Mr. Chair?
It's very impressive, yes.
Could you please use a different example than the Bank Stadium, please? Yeah,
I know, but you have to keep it simple, Representative Grunhagen. So, Representative Dabney, I know you have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, as you'll recall last year, I was a little late to the party on this one. I had some hesitations. And it appears that I was wrong. Where I was wrong was coming on board with supporting this. I listened to the testimony we received last week in this committee from a superintendent in the East Metro, where they've used the scholarship program to get children into their High Five preschool program and have received 10% of the money owed. I look at our region, Hennepin, that includes Hennepin County, that you and I both represent. The most recent statistics are less than half of the scholarships have been issued. My school district has a waiting list, real children, real names, real families who've really chosen the High Five program in the Minneapolis Public Schools, and it's 600 children on the waiting list, not being served by this program. 66 children are being served, and no money has been received by the school district to pay for the early education of those children. I can't get away from my feeling that this program is set up best with a 9-page application for wealthy, middle-aged economists and not for little kids who it's supposed to serve. This program makes the rollout of MNsure look like best practices. Why would we put more money into a program that's leaving 600 children on a waiting list, not issuing the scholarships it promised, and not paying the providers who are taking care of the children who are receiving those scholarships?
Representative Winkler?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, you've made your feelings very well known right now in committee. I wish we could have had an opportunity to talk about some of your concerns earlier rather than here now when we have 2 minutes left in a hearing to talk about this program. I will acknowledge that creating a program and getting money out in less than 1 year when it's brand new is a challenge. I think the Department of Education has acknowledged, and you haven't had the benefit of the testimony in the early childhood committee, they have acknowledged some of the challenges in the application and getting the money out. You might be interested to know, however, that in the Pathway 2 scholarship amounts, the Minneapolis School District actually gets more, a greater percentage of those scholarships through those slots than they do under the school readiness formula. So they actually do better. And rural Minnesota actually does better under that than they do under the school readiness formula. So I acknowledge, and I think there is some, you know, the schools have raised some concerns. I'm not sure that all of them are entirely fair about how quickly the money has gone out. But I would just suggest that with less than a year in its operation, You are already changing lives of real kids in real districts all over the state, and the complaints of school administrators are relevant and important, but they are not how we measure the success of the program. So I'm sorry that you're unhappy with the way that has turned out, and I'm sorry that you don't support it, but when you look at the results and the money that's going out and the lives that it's changing, it works. It might not work perfectly yet, but it is working.
Got a couple. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I raised these concerns last week before the committee and immediately got a phone call from a provider. And I walked through much of what I just said, the systematic policy change problems with the implementation of the program. And she emailed me back with a very sweet story of one child who was being helped. Great. No argument. Wonderful. But how about the 600 kids on the waiting list who've chosen Minneapolis Public Schools for their early childhood provider who aren't being served by this program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney has said at the beginning that 9% of children who are eligible are being served because of the amount of funds available. The story of kids who aren't getting the scholarships is an important part of this story, and that's why I'm bringing the bill forward.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I brought up a concern of information that we had the last time we viewed what was happening with these scholarships, and it showed that like half of them hadn't been released in the metro area, in the district, in the community in which I live in, and they poo-pooed it and said, well, if we would have asked this question a week later, the data would be different. I don't know if people remember that, and I'm hoping that we can get that data because I really would like it. So I called up my school district and asked them, are you seeing scholarships in your community of getting these, because I see this data and I see half of them haven't been released yet. And they knew, in one of my school districts, they knew of one, and they're trying to keep an eye open and trying to figure out who's getting them. They know of one student who has received a scholarship. So it would be helpful for me to get an understanding on how these scholarships are actually getting into our community, and I'm not sure how to go about to get that information.
Mr. Chair, there is a testifier here who can answer that. You are out of time. The concerns of your committee have not been raised with the bill author at any point that I have heard. And I think that is either warrants an extended committee time or perhaps a discussion to get to the root of it rather than having this sort of dialogue
I agree with you 100%, Representative Winkler. So I'm going to, this time, ask for anyone who isn't with one of the groups here to testify here for or against House File 1880. See none. Representative Winkler, any closing comments on House File 1880 before I lay this over?
Mr. Chair, I feel like we are far from closing comments.
Very good. The chair will lay over House File 1880 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And members, thanks for your patience. We are adjourned.